me, who within 5 minutes has forgotten what I've observed. And I can't imagine that the legal standard turns on that kind of subtlety.
I'm talking about the actual recording of the information, the collecting of the information.
I understand, but an officer
and
with
writing it in an open. Mr. Fish, I'm sorry. I'm not talking about a human being's mind and brain, no matter how much they act like a character on TV that can remember everything she sees. I'm talking about a physical recording of information onto a hard drive, which is what these cameras are going to be doing. And that's what I'm concerned about. It's collecting and then maintaining information in violation, I believe, of the state law.
You done?
Well, I just wanted to add one more thing, which is that I've often said about the U.S. policy of endless war that George Orwell meant 1984 as a warning and not a blueprint. And I will caution City Council that this is another step toward Big Brother, and that you should think about that, too, that it was a warning and not a blueprint.
Thank you, Mr. Hanneman. Hi, welcome.
Hi. Being picked up here. Becky Strauss with the ACLU of Oregon. Happy to hear an Orwell reference today. I'm going to start with the drug impact areas and then, like Dan, move on to a couple comments about the surveillance cameras. In regard to the drug impact areas, I think it would be helpful to have a significant amount of additional information in the report. I was pleased to see a little of that provided by the district attorney who testified, but just had the report to go off of when I was preparing for today. And I just think it's impossible to evaluate the effectiveness of the program without further context about what's going on. So I have three things I want to pull out. The first is related to judicial discretion and court oversight. The report mentions an improvement from the prior program of the drug-free zones, that being that judicial discretion over issuance of the exclusions is involved, and I do agree that that's an improvement. But I'm curious about how that's playing out in reality. It seems a little bit actually more concerning than less concerning from the DA's comments today that that none of the, I don't remember how he phrased it exactly, but none of the proposals by the DA for an exclusion to be issued have been denied by a judge. That makes me think that this is less about a judicial decision than about the DA making the determinations, and I'm unclear what criteria is being used to determine who's getting an exclusion and who's not. So that's my first point. The second is related to after the exclusions are issued in terms of violations of those exclusion orders. I'm not seeing anything in the report about data talking about how many people violate the exclusions. When someone's picked up in an exclusion zone when they have an exclusion order, what's the charge that they're picked up on? Is it just because they're there, or is there an additional charge that they're being picked up on? How long are they held? And I would like to see some racial demographic information about those people being picked up on violations. And then the third thing that I wanted to pull out, there was some good discussion about the difference between the incident occurring inside or outside the exclusion zone. And I would also be interested and would love to have the report include some of this additional information about, first of all, what the criteria is for of those people, look at the numbers, of the 810 convictions of crimes occurring outside the zones, 277 were issued exclusions. I'm wondering what criteria is used to figure out who gets an exclusion, who doesn't.
It's drug-related crimes.
I understand that, but between the conviction to the exclusion, there are more people being convicted of the crime than being issued an exclusion.
Oh, a lot of your comments, both of you, are related to, you know, should be made to Multnomah County. So I understand you absolutely have every right and welcome your overall comments. And I'll let you finish, but I encourage you to have the conversation with the courts and in some cases the DA. Did you want to finish your testimony?
Thank you. I would like to, and just the reason I'm presenting these here is this is before you for acceptance of the report.
I'm aware.
Don't believe that the report provides enough context to We encourage you not to accept the report. I'll move on to the cameras. And you have my written testimony, so I won't take too much time and just we'll go ahead and summarize. I do want to frame this discussion and appreciate the fact that we are having the discussion. I think that when we think about technology and the increased use of technology in law enforcement activities, it's really important that we closely examine to what extent the technology will effectively aid in public safety and then at what cost to our fundamental civil liberties. I don't believe that the increased use of cameras by the police on private property strikes the right balance. I think that we forego a significant amount of privacy that the people of Portland and visitors to Portland are entitled to.
Can I just ask on that point?
Sure.
Because you raised some, I think, important legal issues. Are there cases that you are aware of in either other jurisdictions in Oregon or elsewhere where ACLU has been successful in advancing that argument and cameras are not being used in this manner? I mean, have courts stepped in here and said that, along the lines of your argument, that these cameras do infringe basic rights?
I'm not aware of any cases particularly that the ACLU is involved in. I'm happy to follow up if I become aware, but to my knowledge, not in Oregon right now.
Because, I mean, I think in cities across the country, this is routine now. Places like New York, where every street corner there's a camera. I'm just curious if the courts have weighed in to give us some guidance.
Commissioner Fish, I'm not aware of cases in Oregon. I would, to respond to your comparison, I think that the cities who are utilizing these the most, New York, Chicago, San Francisco, are very different cities than Portland, certainly much larger population scales, much larger police bureaus. And so I think we should take that into context when we make the comparison about other cities.
And how do you respond to the public opinion survey that says that a majority of Portlanders support the use of surveillance in high crime rate areas?
I don't think that the public opinion, Mayor Adams, I don't believe that the public opinion changes the fact that there is a relinquishment of
privacy.
Well,
you were just saying
rights.
That we're different than those cities, and then before that, before we asked you the question, you were saying you seem to infer that Portlanders would not support this if they knew about it, and we actually asked Portlanders.
In my comparison, I was referring actually to the population of the cities in their difference,
okay.
Just a different scale of policing and of...
So we'll let you finish now. Thank you.
Thank you. Just to raise a few other things, I mean, I think that there are significant risks as we begin to increase the use of technology, particularly here, surveillance cameras. I think there's a risk of invading one's freedom to be anonymous in a public place and one's behavior as they're walking and engaging in legal activities in public places. One possible consequence of that is a chilling and deterrence of freedom of speech, association, and assembly in those public places. We also want to mention the risk of misuse. The chief has mentioned that these will be used on smartphones by officers primarily.
Now you really need to summarize.
Oh, sure. Okay. Well, you have the written testimony, so I won't go too far. The final thing I just wanted to mention is that we haven't seen that. Our position is that this is a waste of money and resources. We don't think that the trade-off actually increases public safety and have not seen any evidence that the use of cameras deters crime.
So if you go on the internet, you can see plenty of evidence. Just Google it. So why do you make that statement? Usually ACLU has very informed and fact-based statements, but that last one I have respectfully submit, just make a simple internet search.
Mayor Adams, I would be very interested to see what you're seeing as demonstrations and evidence of the effectiveness of surveillance cameras.
You said don't work. You didn't say effectiveness. You said they don't work. They don't prevent crime, and they don't solve crime, and we can tell you that that's patently not accurate.
I would be happy to forward on a couple studies that I have demonstrating that...
No, not I'm talking about real life in the real city of Portland that I am personally familiar with, and things you care about, like misconduct by police officers caught on tape that allowed us to sort of cut through the everybody says something different. So I'm sorry to put you on the spot, but that last statement was a bit of a overreach, because we do have cases where videotape solved something, helped us apprehend someone who is dangerous, and help us catch misconduct that we otherwise probably would not have been able to pursue or succeed at. So I would just ask you to please just do a simple search, and the evidence, there is evidence. You can argue whether or not it's worth the trade-off, but there is evidence, compelling evidence, that it does work. Thank you. Sir?
My name is Joe Walsh, and I'm representing the Oregon Progressive Party and Individuals for Justice. We are very much against the cameras. I'm here to speak to the cameras. We think it's a dumb idea. Mayor, you say that it helps in crime prevention. Well, let me present this. The people that you arrest, try, and convict using cameras are the dumb criminals. Anybody with a brain would know where the cameras are and would not hold up bags of cocaine so the camera can catch it. Here, camera, catch me on camera. That's what you're saying works. I think these cameras will be used for what happened yesterday during the parades, during the protests. That's when you use them. Because to use them in a drug transaction, the people would turn their backs to the cameras. They would go to another place. They would go around the corner. They would go in an alley. They would go in your office.
I have cameras.
Because there's no cameras there.
We all have cameras in our office.
I didn't know that. See?
See what?
What we're doing here is what London has done. There are cameras, and you know this, Amanda, there are cameras every 10 feet in London. You cannot walk down the street and do anything without being on camera. And I think the ACLU's and Dan's question is this: who's going to control the film? We don't know that. You're saying, when you were doing your question, you were saying, well, it's going to be redone every 24 hours, so it's gone. We don't know that. The police officers are telling that's what they're going to do. And the problem with civil liberties people that worry about these things is we don't trust the police. We don't want a whole bunch of police cameras in Portland. That's what we're saying. We fear the police, and we have good reason to fear. And all the examples that you gave, I could give you examples of misbehaving of the police.
Caught on film.
Caught on film.
Exactly.
Okay. So is that the trade-off?
If you
want to know everything about me, put a camera in my living room. Why can't you do that?
That's a ridiculous comparison.
No, it isn't.
It is to me.
Putting a camera on private property is going to be used for other things, and it'll almost never be used
so
in
I
court
respect
of law
your,
to convict somebody,
your time
and you
it,
know it, and I know it.
I don't agree with you.
How are you going to do that?
I want to ask you a question.
I can do a drug transaction right here in front of you, and you couldn't see it if the camera was right over your head.
Sir, do you have cable TV?
Yes.
Okay, are you familiar with shows titled America's Stupidest Criminals?
No.
Okay, there really are a lot of stupid criminals out there, and they get caught on tape, and their entire show's devoted to them. So it's one thing to... I find compelling the discussion about protecting liberties and using modern tools to prevent and apprehend criminal behavior. So I think that's a great discussion. That's why this is, part of the ADA. Let me finish.
There has been no discussion. This is the discussion.
I'm asking you to be quiet because I listen to you. And that's why this is on the council. That's why we're having this discussion right now.
Why is it on an emergency system?
But to say it doesn't work, again, when you make those kinds
it
of
arguments.
It
doesn't work what it's designed to work for, but it works for other
worked.
Things.
Your
it
time
works
is,
really well for protests.
And there has been plenty of videotape at protests that has resulted in.
You want more?
Sir, listen to me. Well, then don't interrupt. There's been plenty of videotape at protests that has resulted in discipline for police, too.
Really?
Yeah.
Where?
We're happy.
You can't even fire a policeman who shot somebody in the back.
You're now on to other topics. Thank you. Ma'am.
Good afternoon. I'm Suzanne Hayden. I'm the executive director of the Citizens Crime Commission, and I'm here today to speak to both items 442 and 443 on the agenda. I'm here on behalf of the Citizens Crime Commission, and we support the efforts of the council and particularly the leadership that the mayor has shown on the illegal drug impact areas. About a year ago, we co-hosted with the Portland Business Alliance and the Clean and Safe and the Office of Neighborhood Involvement a business summit, a safety summit. And at that time, business owners and managers who were in attendance were extremely upset about what they were seeing outside their businesses with drug dealing, drug usage, and just criminal activity in the Old Town, Chinatown, and downtown areas. So the creation of the illegal drug impact areas has made a significant difference. We just hosted another safety summit in April, and the response from the attendees there was they had seen a dramatic reduction in the type of criminal activity that they had seen just merely a year ago. I've been to multiple public forums where DA Prince presented information about the program and observed that there was great support in audiences that were extremely diverse audiences, not just business audiences, but residents, members of social service agencies. So we're very supportive of this program. It's a great collaborative approach, and it's very responsive to citizens and to social service providers, business owners, and so we appreciate the efforts on our behalf for public safety. We also support the ability of the police chief to enter into access and indemnity agreements with private property owners who, for placement of city-owned surveillance cameras on private property. And this offers an opportunity for willing private property owners to engage with and partnership with the police to deter, interdict, and investigate criminal activity. And in the last 10 years, as Commissioner Fish has mentioned, the presence of cameras on our public spaces have become ubiquitous and provide a real potential for enhanced investigation and evidence collection in support of criminal prosecution. Most downtown buildings, if not all, have cameras that are present, and the problem comes with, and they're accessible to police as well, but the problem comes with quickly accessing that information on a timely basis. I used to be a district attorney, and evidence in the form of visual imaging capturing a crime in progress really made a significant difference in my decision whether to prosecute and the strength of the case when it was prosecuted. In one case I particularly recall, I had a really vulnerable victim who had been assaulted, and the victim was unable to testify as a result of their mental impairments, but the assault was captured by a gas station video camera, and we were able to prosecute that case and protect that victim's rights. So criminal activity creates a significant barrier to vital business climate, and this technology provides additional support to police in maintaining safety and increasing their effectiveness. It also supports businesses in the area where there's a higher criminal activity, and we think it's a very nice public-private partnership. And thank you for your time.
Thank you all very much. If we could have the...
We have one more speaker.
Oh.
Devin Pack.
Sorry, I didn't want to leave you out. And then we'll have the city district attorney and the chief of police could come back up. Hi, welcome. Thanks for waiting.
Thank you. First of all, I'd like to say that oppression can be like air pollution.
You state your name for the record.
Yes, my name is Devin Pack. I am here speaking just as a citizen. I am not in regards to any of the groups that I am an activist with. So I just wanted to say that. This does not represent anything from Occupy or the Green Party or the Brady campaign, for that matter. First of all, I'd like to say that oppression can be like air pollution in the sense that it appears invisible until you look up and you notice how the skies have been darkened, whether by smog or by the presence of surveillance cameras. We have extensive studies from the United Kingdom, which has instituted the most extensive and expensive surveillance camera project in the world's history, that have shown that there is no deterrent effect. There are studies by the University of Wales, the University of Leicester, Cambridge University, the Assembly of London, and multiple reports by the British Home Office, which have shown that surveillance camera programs can be an expensive distraction from effective law enforcement strategies. Today we are hearing from two programs which are inverse programs in their effectiveness. One, the drug impact exclusion zone is effective because it promotes community policing and policemen walking the beat, whereas a program of surveillance camera takes away from the physical interaction and the human intelligence, which is the most effective factor in effective law enforcement. One figure that I saw shows that surveillance cameras, now this may be with private contractors in the UK, it may be possible to get more effective cost controls, cost an average of $4,000 to install and then $800 per camera to maintain. That is to say, going by those figures, 15 cameras could keep another police officer on the force. This year, our public safety budget, as I understand it, we are facing a loss of 56 good police officers. And another problem with surveillance cameras is that they encourage a false security, both in the citizens and a false security in the sense of the officers. I don't need to be on the beat. I don't need to know what's happening because the camera is there to catch it. That false sense of security, it detracts from the policing work that needs to happen. Lastly, I would like to appeal that we do not just exist within a Fourth Amendment protection of privacy, but there's also the sense of a general ambient atmosphere of liberty that needs to be protected as well. The studies of Britain show that there have been many abuses of the surveillance camera by people from world news and media establishment bribing police officers. So even if there's this 24-hour surveillance...
Thanks for your testimony. Mm-hmm. Appreciate it. All right, District Attorney and Chief of Police. Come forward. Commissioner Fish.
Thank you, Mayor. Gentlemen, based on the discussion that we've had with prior witnesses, I have four questions I just would like to put to you. The first is, according to the financial impact statement, for item number 443, there is no cost to the city for entering into this indemnification agreement. But it strikes me that there is going to be a cost associated with this program. So do you have estimates of the costs of equipment and monitoring and whatever resources that you're going to need to put into this?
It's cost neutral. We already have the equipment.
So there's no cost to the city?
No.
Both in terms of the indemnification and the implementation of the program?
The cost would be the time that it would take to install a camera.
And if I could just reinforce a point you made earlier, which is key, is right now for some crime hotspots, we have to send an officer physically to that location to find out if there's anybody there. If a camera shows that nobody is at a particular location, then it saves the time of having the only option of sending an officer from northeast to east Portland and around.
Thank you, Chief. Second, we heard a discussion about whether ORS 181575 applies, and frankly, I don't know whether it does or doesn't. I guess the question is, what are your intentions in terms of the footage that is recorded? What will be the Bureau's policy with respect to any tapes that are generated?
The system itself is just constantly overwritten. So it's like many businesses own that the information is recorded over, so you're not saving it unless the investigator physically goes and pulls a copy of the recording for a criminal prosecution. And again, we've asked the city attorney for guidance in this area, and he said there is no conflict with state law. And in fact, the courts have had heard your discussion with the ACLU attorney. Again, the courts have weighed in on this and have said that it is appropriate for law enforcement in public settings. There are no privacy rights, according to the city attorney, that would be violated, and courts have weighed in on that issue.
And the city attorney has advised us in our office and put it on the record that it's, unless there is any sort of reason otherwise, and your answer is sort of the technical in terms of the technology answer, but if we can't keep anything longer than 60 days.
And I guess
if there's no indication of a crime having been suspected.
And I guess to the district attorney's office, is there any case law in particular that you would want to bring to our attention to guide our decision today?
Regarding the drug impact area?
Well, actually,
surveillance cameras?
Surveillance cameras.
No. I mean, if we had surveillance cameras, it's evidence. Is it going to be helpful to a trier of fact in a case? Absolutely, right? So I don't know of any case that would say because it was obtained in any particular manner, as long as we knew it was what it was, that it wasn't an animation or something like that, then we would be able to use it.
Well, Mayor, I'm just going to, when we take this to a vote, I'm going to propose a friendly amendment that either at 6 months or a year, whatever council thinks is appropriate, we get a report on how this program is working and whether, so that we can have a further discussion about some of the legal issues that have been raised by our critics. Thank you.
Thank you. I'd absolutely take that as a friendly amendment. We can do a motion on it too, but let's have other discussion.
Okay.
Commissioner Saltzman.
Thank you. I want to ask you one of the questions the ACLU raises in its written testimony. Will the cameras have the ability to zoom and turn, and can those functions be engaged remotely? How close can they zoom? Through windows of private property, I would add, I guess, private residential property.
Well, of course, it would depend on where the camera was aimed, whether or not it could observe something in a where there was a privacy interest. Now, we would never be able to use that in a case. That would be a violation of the law. Courts have been very clear that you cannot, as a police officer, collect evidence inside a residence using technology. So we've had cases.
My interest is less in making a criminal case than it is, you know, a person's home is their castle, to quote Commissioner Leonard.
Yeah, certainly if we were to train a camera on a residence, we would collect evidence or collect information, but we would not be able to do that, and it would not be good policing to do that.
The cameras turn and zoom.
Absolutely. The technology exists for cameras to pan and tilt and zoom in, and
so I guess,
it's constantly changing and evolving.
Okay, well, I guess the concern I have is, you know, there's a little bit of voyeur in all of us, and the temptation would be the temptation.
Hold on.
I'm not saying
speaking for all of my colleagues up here. No, I'm serious. The temptation to be a voyeur. I mean, there's a little bit of it in all of us, and the temptation I'm concerned here is too great for officers to stray from the streets into somebody's apartment.
I can't imagine any of our officers wanting to.
Well, I guess to the point
that and and do we have risk in their career over.
If do I we could, have an order or policy and procedure that specifically prohibits that with
I'd
respect
be happy
to
put that into policy. I'm sure it's already covered under our conduct policies, but I'd be happy to put it into any policy. Okay.
And then the other question I have is, and, you know, Mayor, with all due respect, I think I want to see that policy before I'm prepared to vote today on this. Secondly, these cameras will be operating wireless. They'll be downloading images to officers with smartphones. Are these signals going to be at all encrypted so that anybody, I mean, so nobody else can really sort of hack into our system and take advantage of these cameras?
Again, if you had an IP address, you would be able to watch. Typically, most camera systems that operate now are IP address based so that you can dial in that address and pull it up on any laptop computer. So you'd have to have that particular password to get into it. Again, these cameras are not focused on anything except public right of way. So public intersections, public sidewalks. And so if someone, if they were to tap into our camera system, they would simply be watching a drug deal in Old Town or an area where we...
But could they, and this is getting beyond my level of understanding, but I'm not, I'm constantly amazed at the ability of hackers to do things. And so could they hack in and control the cameras, I guess, and then look in private residential property, for instance?
Again, the cameras are focused. There's going to be a limit to how far they tilt and pan. It's individual. The technology is constantly evolving. I'd have to get one of our techs here to know whether or not somebody could hack in and actually control a camera.
Okay, I guess those are both answers I need, both on the policy and procedure about not looking in private and residential property and the consequences thereof. And then I need some more technical information before I can vote today on this.
So if you go to the cameras right now, and you can, a lot of the public cameras, you can tilt pan on your own as a member of the public and zoom in. But you can't tilt them into private spaces. And there are thousands of these out there. So that's one thing. The second thing is, just as a police officer can't, without any probable cause or without a court order, can't sit in front of a house and just wait, staring into the windows and look for something bad to happen inside the house. The same rules of conduct apply. Just because it's a camera doesn't change the same rules of conduct that exist right now on the general orders and in local policy and state law and federal law. Those expectations don't change.
Well, again, I think the discussion all focuses for the intent of criminal purposes.
Absolutely.
I am more concerned about misuse of these cameras for non-criminal purposes. And so I guess I would like to see, and I think you can do this by next week, you know, a general order that speaks to the protection of privacy through the use of these cameras and their Zooms. And I'd like some more assurance from the Bureau of Technology Services or your technology folks about how safe or unsafe are these from being, you know, hacked into and taken over. And if the answer is, you know, they're not safe, they're just like any other camera system that's capable of being hacked into, okay, I'll accept that and factor that into my vote. But
again, I think that would be a good question for our technology folks, but no system is going to be bulletproof. Any computer system we have is going to be has the capability of being hacked into, and as good as our folks are at BTS, I'm certain they would tell you that there's nothing they can do to prevent every situation.
Yeah, and that's something I can have a meeting with whoever in the intervening week, but I do want to see, by the time I vote next week, a general policy and procedure that speaks to the protection of privacy with these cameras.
We're going to move on.
And Commissioner the consequences for violating that policy.
Thank you, Mayor. You mentioned that we already have these cameras. What are they doing now?
We have cameras in some of our investigations where we're watching drug dealers or other people engaged in criminal activity.
So we'd be reassigning where they are currently located to new places?
The investigations come and go. So there are investigations that are resolved through an arrest, and that we have a finite number of cameras, but we have enough that if we were to place one in Old Town, Chinatown, focused on an intersection that would stay there until maybe that intersection no longer was a hot spot.
Okay, thank you. And then as far as the indemnification, we are assuming some risk should the camera fall off on somebody. So do we?
We would assume that anyway. This just protects the owner from also being sued as well.
So it's no additional. And I would also like to see the policy encapsulating what you've told us today in terms of the technology and the procedures so that everybody is clear what the limitations are. I think that will be very helpful.
Okay, we'll do it. Commissioner Leonard, any thoughts?
Well, do you just, given that 443 has an emergency clause, do you want to take it off or move it forward to next week's calendar with an emergency clause? Do you care?
I'd just move it to next week's calendar with an emergency clause, assuming we can satisfy people.
Then it'll take effect immediately. I'm assuming you want to do that.
Is that all right?
Yes.
Okay. So that was, unless there's objections, this will be moved. The item number, which item number?
443.
443 will be moved for consideration at next city council meeting. We'll come back and post on our web answers to the questions. Thank you for that. No objections, so done. And then move acceptance of the IDIA report.
Second.
And moved and seconded. Please call the vote on the motion.
Aye.
Saltzman?
Aye.
Leonard?
Well, I think it's unfortunate that these, as it turns out, I didn't anticipate this, that these two items were read together because they're two distinctly actually unrelated issues. And it's unfortunate that a discussion on cameras detracted from what I think is the stellar work done by you, Chief Reese, and your team going back to when you were commander of Central Precinct and authorized then Officer Jeff Myers to initiate the service coordination team. You've just been a person that's embraced this approach, which turns out to be a unique approach in the United States, so much that I remember a couple of years back, Victoria, B.C. came down to ask about it and to be showed how it works. And that specifically being that we consciously developed a, for want of a better word, a carrot and stick approach, that is understanding the nature of addictions and the tragedy that follows that for some people you have to give them really little choice but to enter treatment. And therein lies the magic of this program is that you give people the opportunity to, while they're in jail, clear their mind enough to understand that they need to do something about their addictions. And when we get them into treatment, we find they drop off the radar in terms of committing crimes and other offenses in the community, but for their addictions, they wouldn't commit. And so the source of the problem literally goes away. I remember the first car I bought. I remember my first day of kindergarten. I remember my first day of high school. I remember the first person I voted for president. I mean, there are these firsts that come in your life that you just had this clarity of, and it was George McGovern. So I always felt a connection to George McGovern because he was the first person I voted for president of the United States. I don't remember who else I voted for on that ballot, but I clearly remember George. And some years later, in fact, it was, December 1994, George McGovern's eldest daughter, Terry McGovern, was living in Madison, Wisconsin. And Terry had battled drug addiction and alcoholism her whole adult life. She had been in a place to dry out. They let her out that afternoon. The staff was actually working on paperwork to convict her or commit her involuntarily to a treatment program when she went into a bar that night, that December night in 94, and drank so much she left and passed out in the snow and froze to death. That led to George McGovern writing a book in 1996 simply called Terry. And when I read the review in the Oregonian, along with the review was a scheduled appearance date by Senator McGovern up here at the church. I think it's Southwest 11th and Main
and he was appearing to talk about the book. So I made a point. I bought the book, and I went. And I remember listening to him talk, and I just thought, I just don't know how he does this. And I had a chance afterwards, when I signed the book, to tell him, you know, that I was struggling with some of those same issues with my own daughter, and that I did not know how he was able to stand and talk about what he talked about and write what he wrote so powerfully. And he said it was part of his way of healing. So I think the message there for those who are critics of the compulsory treatment, pseudo-compulsory treatment side of this is people are beyond just the immediate person are dramatically affected when a family member is addicted to drugs. There are spouses, sometimes there are children, oftentimes there are parents, there are certainly always friends, and it's really hard to calculate the impact that kind of a disease has on people who love the person addicted. And as horrible as some of these people behave and some of them appear, that is not the person that the loved ones know. So, I almost made it. So, as I approach next Tuesday, the anniversary of my own daughter's death, this is a poignant reminder to me how important this program is. And I personally am familiar with many. I apologize. Many stories. We talked, Mick, is it Mick? Mick and I talked the other day how when Carol was at NARA, in one of the programs that she was at for 6 months, I would go every Sunday and spend the afternoon with Cole, and we'd play ping pong. And you reminded me of that. I shared that with Cole, and he fondly remembered experience. And it's a program that I've met people like Mick and then Gary, who was here earlier, people who were different people at one point in their lives. And this program, of anything I've ever done in public life, has had the most immediate and direct and dramatic impact on people's lives that I've witnessed, being a firefighter or being a member of the council. Mick is an example of that. Gary is definitely an example of that. And I know Austin knows of many more. So, again, my thanks to you, Chief Reese, because, you know, I've learned here, as anybody who's elected has learned, that we can come up with ideas, we can pass ordinances, but we can't create passion. And you've had a passion for this program before it was even a program, and you've grabbed it, you've put the right people in charge, and you've embraced it, and you've done it for the right reasons. I and my family thank you, and the people that have been saved thank you, but certainly the citizens who aren't victims of crimes as a result of people continuing to use and abuse drugs don't do once they are put into this program, but they thank you as well. So I'm really pleased to be able to sit here and vote yes.
Fritz. Thank you, Commissioner Leonard, for reminding us why what we do is important, and I acknowledge your leadership on this program way back when, and it's still evolving. And I appreciated the comments earlier that we need to look at people with mental health diagnoses and dual diagnoses in addition to people with drug and alcohol addictions to provide this kind of wraparound service, because it's working. And indeed, that's part of the approach with the drug impact area, is to coordinate between the county, the city, police, social services, and help people. I appreciated the comments about the woman who dared to testify because she knew it was going to help somebody else who had been in her shoes. And so that I'm very supportive of continuing that. I appreciate it. We're voting to accept the report. And so I appreciate the comments from CopWatch and the ACLU about some of the numbers in it. I think that the numbers, both inside and outside the drug impact area, show that we still have some disparities in who is getting arrested, convicted, sent to prison. And that, as the mayor accurately noted, is something that we need to work on as a community and address. There's a lot of good work being done, and I appreciate all of your investment in the reason that we're doing this good work, which is, as Commissioner Leonard just so aptly described. Aye.
Adams.
On the issue of surveillance cameras, I think the discussion is really important, and as always, the City Council improves on most every day, improves upon the work that comes before them, and I think the discussion will go back and improve upon this. Because I couldn't be here at the first time that it was up at the City Council, we moved it to this date, and it does overshadow, as Commissioner Leonard talked about, the IDIA, but I think it's, with that downside, I think it's important that they sort of go together, because Teresa Rofford, whose loved one, Andrew Payton, was killed in one of our drug and violence hotspots when we raised this issue to the Friday gang group, said, I wish there would have been a camera there when my family member was shot. So I think the protection of civil liberties is very important. But I also don't want to, any of us, and I'm not talking about my colleagues or city staff, but I also don't want to just dismiss the idea that this can also prevent crimes and solve crimes. It does. And this isn't London, as we've heard. This isn't New York or Chicago. But I want it out there. On the ADIA, I want to underscore my thanks as a Portlander to Commissioner Leonard and then Commander Reese and others for putting together the service coordination team. And then on top of that, to bringing back the IDIA, and the partnership with the county, it's showing remarkable results, absolutely remarkable results, and is being looked to as a national best practice, and it should. So thank you for all your work. To the ACLU, I think the questions that you raise are great. I think that your argument might be strengthened by noting the holistic approach that we've taken here around the ADIU. And I would say that, respectfully, I would submit that to Mr. Handelman as well. This is taking a people-based approach to solving a problem, not simply arresting them and getting them into the legal system. This city is investing in a holistic approach to trying to help people who sometimes can't help themselves and who are impacted deeply, often by crime and by drugs or mental health issues. And so encourage it to sort of wrestle with all these issues like we do together, and not just a slice. Because I really do want your insights. And if you just grapple with a slice, then your feedback to us, you know, frankly, isn't as useful. And you've got great experience, great organizations behind you, and I really want you engaged in the full picture. So thank you. Aye. All right, that moves us on to... That moves us on to... is there anyone here to testify on items 469, 470, 471? They're technically not all of them second reading, just one is. So there is no one here to testify, which can, Carla, would you please read the titles and call the votes?
469, adopt the communications annex to the basic emergency operations plan. Fish?
Aye.
Saltzman?
Aye.
Leonard?
Aye.
Fritz?
Aye.
Adams?
Aye.
470, rename the Portland Office of Emergency Management to the Portland Bureau of Emergency Management. Fish?
Aye.
Saltzman?
Congratulations, Director Merlo.
Aye.
Leonard?
Aye.
Fritz?
Aye.
Adams?
So it's now called PORBIM? PORTBIM?
PBIM.
PORLANDBIM? PBIM. Aye.
471. Adopt the Earthquake Response Appendix to the Basic Emergency Operations Plan. Fish?
Aye.
Saltzman?
Aye.
Leonard?
Aye.
Fritz?
Aye.
Adams?
Aye. Before my council colleagues disappear, I will not be in the 2 o'clock because I do need to finish up the mayor's proposed so that I can begin to brief you all. And so President Fish will conduct this afternoon session.
So you have 2 hours to kiss up to you?
Fat chance. This is just brutal.
I know. You did a nice job.